But last 2 weeks ago on the show, I had a guest, Kira, and we were sharing some stories, and I had told a story about an interaction I had had a few days earlier behind my house, or I call it the front of my house where the bike path goes, the bike path bench out there. There was an incident with a man who said he'd gotten hit by a car and had also been drinking some. The paramedics and the police came, and they weren't as respectful as I would have liked. And it was pretty upsetting to me and my neighbor who had called 911. And so anyway, so I knew I needed to talk to the police about it and give the officers some feedback. So a few days after that happened, this was maybe 2.5 weeks ago now that happened. So a few days afterwards, one of my guests, a guest that was staying with us, I asked her, "Hey, what are you doing? Can you do something for me? Come with me to the police station." And so we went together, because just to go in sometimes for me can be a little intimidating, because you go in and if you want to talk to someone, there's like this big glass, like kind of tinted glass window, and you have to pick up the receiver on a phone on the wall outside the glass, and then you can kind of see one of the two officers inside, you know, picking up their end of the phone, and they ask you what, you know, how can they help you? Anyway, so my friend Elvis went in with me to ask, and I was a little bit nervous. But what ended up happening was someone came out and said, they asked me when the incident had happened, and I told them, and they said, "Well, you should talk to the shift supervisor for that shift, for the 3 to 11 shift, since it happened on the 3 to 11 shift." And they're not here right now, so, because it's like it was before 3. Anyway, so I put a little mental note on my to-do list to go back to the police station sometime during the 3 to 11 shift. So the time that I was able to do that, I guess it was last Saturday afternoon, and I was coming from the bike lab, and I didn't have anyone with me, but I had some other things going on in my life where I hadn't been at my best, and I was feeling a little bit vulnerable and down, like I'd made some mistakes, and I was feeling like I just wanted to cry about these other mistakes I'd made, and now I had to go into the police station and talk to a police officer, and I was like, you know what, I need someone to come with me. I don't want to go in there by myself. I'm just going to start crying the minute I pick up the phone. I just can't do that right now, but I need to. But I'm going to look for help. So I sat down on the wall in front of First Church's on Main Street with my bike, and I'm like, you know what, I'm just going to sit here till someone walks by who can help me. And so I sat there for about maybe 15 minutes, and I was like, okay, I just got to go in there. I can't sit here forever. And then my friend Arbor is biking by. I'm like, Arbor, wait, stop. I need your help. How much time do you have? And so Arbor went with me. I was super grateful. Yeah, it was really great to have them as support. And so, yes, we went into the police station and asked for the shift supervisor. And he came out, and you know, I told him a little bit, just briefly, what had happened. I didn't tell him that. I told the person on the phone behind the glass that. So the shift supervisor comes out, and he's like, "Hey, how about we go to this conference room and we can talk?" So we went to this conference room, and it was really nice to have two of us, me and Arbor. And the shift supervisor was great. He just like listened, didn't get defensive at all. It was like one of the things he said that I appreciated. He was like, "Yeah, you know, officers go from one call to another call to another call, and that can get tiresome, but each time we're at a new call with a new person, that's a new person, and we shouldn't, you know, carry over any aggravation we have from the previous call to a new person." And he did agree that it wasn't the most compassionate thing that the officer had done. Anyway, separate from the whole structural issues and historical issues of police and capitalism and all that, it was a good personal interaction. But I just wanted to have that little follow-up in case anyone who's listening now had heard the story 2 weeks ago. I'll get it on the archives when Alex comes back into town. He's my link to the internet world. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. And no, since you're here, I want to ask you a few things before I get to the interview with James. I want to ask you about, so you're new to the area, right?
I'm new to the area, yes.
Yeah, speak. but you're trying to relocate here, yeah?
Yeah, I'm trying to move here. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, and have been in this area for a few weeks. And
and so, like, this whole relocation thing, you got to figure out housing, employment. How's things going? How are you figuring this out?
It's been pretty stressful. I think the light at the tunnel is being able to stay at Pedal People and having that support through it all. I don't know how I would do it without community.
Yeah.
It's a big thing.
Yeah, like couch surfing or just other like networks that you're part of to try and find people.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then like employment, like resumes, and I don't know, like also you're talking about like you're trying to live with a group of people and
yeah, it almost comes down to it where like if you don't have employment and you're trying to find a place to live, it's too expensive to live on your own. But then it gets complicated with trying to find people that are all like on the same page and want to live together.
Because you don't, I mean, you're meeting people that you've never met before and trying to make a decision if you're going to move in together September 1st, right?
Yeah.
It makes me think of arranged marriages. No, but even though, like, that's not like that at all. Arranged marriages are like people in your community that your parents know, you know, typically, right?
Is it? Yeah. I think the only connection that we have is being queer and like being a part of the queer community is like our only link.
That leaves a lot of other room for differences, I imagine.
Yeah, it's been showing a little bit.
Mm-hmm. So you were also telling me the other day about Rent NoHo and how that works, because I see the signs around what was your experience?
It just seems like Rent NoHo is like this umbrella that they're going around the Northampton area and just getting a hold of a lot of rental properties and trying to take it off the hands of certain like people that may find it difficult to rent out places. So they're getting their own realtors and I don't know if they're taking away the middleman or what they're doing exactly, but like, they're having to pay the realtors like a big sum, and then that gets put on to the people trying to rent the tenants, future tenants. So it's 60% of the rent up front, and you don't get that back. It goes straight to the realtor.
Like 60% of a month's rent
yeah.
is realtor fees
yeah.
up front? And what's a month's rent that you, like what's a sample rent that you've been looking at?
Nothing less than 1100
for two bedrooms or
two
something?
Bedrooms. Yeah, not mm-hmm. even three bedrooms. Uh-huh. We're thinking about splitting a bedroom in half.
Uh-huh.
Having two people stay in one bedroom.
Yeah.
Yeah. It kind of feels like we're not in a small city. It feels kind of like we're in New York City or like the Bay Area or something, where you have to turn a living room into a bedroom.
Uh-huh. It's interesting because there's also many other houses in town that are quite large with few people living in them.
Yeah.
And then there's other places that...
I think that's kind of America in general.
Like inequality?
Yeah.
Any other stories? Anything else you want to share for now?
I don't think I can think of anything right now.
Well, if you think of something, we can talk more.
Sounds good.
All right. So I'm going to start with the interview with James Lowenthal. James is an astronomy professor at Smith College, an avid cyclist, and a lover of the night. And I ran into him at the Tuesday Market last night, and I was like, James, I haven't seen you in a while. Where have you been? And so he told me.
The cycles of the sun repeat themselves exactly every year.
Not that one.
Exactly.
That's the second clip. Let's get the first one. James, so when I ran into you at the Tuesday Market yesterday, did you just get back from summer camp?
I did. I got back from the best summer camp in the world. My favorite summer camp is out in New Mexico, out in the Wild West. It's called the Cottonwood Gulch Expedition, and they run programs for boys and girls and little kids and adults all around the Southwest.
Wow. So how long were you there, and what was your group like?
I was there for just over a week, and I was co-leading an archaeoastronomy tour, which is designed to look at some of the ancient ancestral Puebloan sites, the archaeological sites scattered around the Four Corners region that have a lot of astronomical significance.
So can you talk a little bit about where you were, who lives there or lived there?
The base camp for the Cottonwood Gulch Foundation is in the Zuni Mountains, the foothills of the Zuni Mountains in New Mexico, just 40 miles from Gallup and about 2 hours from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And that's our base camp. We start there, we load up our trucks, and then we caravan out into the desert and explore the canyons and the mountains of the current day Pueblo Indians, which are the Hopi and the Zuni and the San Ildefonso and the Acoma and so on, the dozens of Pueblo Native American people who live in the Rio Grande Valley area, and we explore their ancestors' sites dating back as far back as 1500 years. We started, for instance, with a trip to Chaco Canyon, which was the epicenter of culture around the year 1000.
So who owns that land, or how is it shared, or who's allowed to go there?
That's a really good question. Right now, Chaco is owned by the National Park Service. It's it's called Chaco Culture National Historic Site, I think. I think it's National Park Service. All of these ancestral Puebloan sites from 1,000 years ago, most of them are owned by the federal government in some way, shape, or form, by the BLM or the National Park Service or the National Forest. But the modern-day Puebloans almost all claim ancestry, and they claim heritage connections to these sites. And things have really changed since even just 10 or 20 years ago, when the attitude was still much more finders keepers. We white folks found these and we can do whatever we want with them. Now there's much more respect and consultation with modern day tribes and how they want the sites to be treated and respected.
Are the modern day Pueblo, are they scattered in reservations or just the towns in and around wherever you were?
It's a mix. There are certainly reservations for almost all of them. For example, Acoma is one of the most famous ones. That's on top of a mesa with very steep cliffs, and the only way you can get there is one road. It was a highly defensible site. And the Acoma are still there, as they have been for hundreds and hundreds of years. And at the same time, many Native Americans in the area are also integrated into the Western culture. If you go into Gallup, New Mexico, for example, you are just as likely to see Native Americans as Anglo cowboys walking down the street.
So you said it was an archaeoastronomy tour. What does that mean?
Archaeoastronomy is the study of ancient sites, use of astronomy to orient their buildings or to make measurements of the sky, the sun, the moon, the stars, the planets, to devise calendars and clocks, to try to organize their own lives, to tell when a solstice is happening so they can tell when to celebrate the return of the sun or things like that. So there were lots of ceremonial and lots of practical reasons for watching the sky, and a lot of that is reflected in the artifacts and the buildings that still stand today.
So what were some of the artifacts and the buildings? Did you have any favorites to explore or look at or touch?
There are so many cool parts to it. It's just fantastic. There are especially Chaco culture. Chaco is the, as I said, the epicenter. Chaco culture, as I said, was the sort of dominant culture around the year 1000, and the Chacoans were at that time obsessed with the cardinal directions and the sky. They were great astronomers. They paid very close attention to how their their structures were aligned exactly north, south, east, west to a small fraction of 1 degree, which takes a lot of skill, both in observing the sky and in constructing these beautiful stone walls. They were master craftspeople. And there were many examples in their architecture of alignments to north, south, east, west, with buildings and obelisks and kivas spread out over many miles aligned to exactly north, south, east, west. And then there are also great examples of holes in a building that would transmit the sunlight on a particular day, like the summer solstice, and illuminate a niche on the far wall. Or there would be a rock face or a large boulder that would cast a shadow or a dagger of light at a particular place on a rock face at noon on the summer solstice. And if you look at that place on that day, what do you see? A spiral that they etched into the rock face. So they knew that was the summer solstice. They knew that that was a significant day, and they had marked it on the wall.
I'm just curious, like, how many do you just need to observe, like, the 1 year and make careful marks for 1 year, and then you got to figure it out? How many years do you have to observe, and, like, how do you figure these things out?
Yeah, that's a matter of some debate. It depends on the particular phenomenon. For example, to see what I just said, that there's a dagger of sunlight that falls on the rock face right at noon on summer solstice. That one, well, you'd observe it once, but you'd want to observe it twice or three times.
Right. I'm thinking maybe you would get the lateral, but then you got the vertical or the, you know, the three-dimensional, all these different, like,
right,
variables.
And then it gets much more complicated when you talk about the cycles of the moon, which are...
Yeah.
The cycles of the sun repeat themselves exactly every year. It's exactly the same cycle. So if the sun light or the sun shadow or the sun position on the horizon appears in one place on a particular day, say December 21st, 1 year, it'll be in exactly the same position the next year. Mm-hmm. The moon, not so. The moon has an 18.6-year cycle that that's much subtler. The moon, let's see, the sun rises at a different position on the horizon every day. All through the year. It rises due east only on the equinoxes, on March 20th and September 21st approximately. And the rest of the time, it's either somewhere north of there or somewhere south of there. It swings back and forth and back and forth like a pendulum over the course of the year. The moon does the same thing in the course of just 1 month. So it's much faster, but the range changes. So it's not exactly the same position repeated month after month. And the size of the range is smaller in some years and bigger in other years. And that cycle takes 18.6 years. And there are places in the Southwest where they observed the so-called major lunar standstill, when the moon is as far north, where the full moon rises really far north of east, as far north as it gets, farther north than the sun ever rises, or the opposite, when it's a much smaller range than it usually is. So these were basically an, you know, 18.5-year calendar, and there's a lot of evidence that that various of the ancestral Puebloans observed these things. For example, in the Sun Temple, where we were just now at Hovenweep National Monument, we didn't get to see it, but I've seen photographs inside of, I think it's a Sun Temple, of four vertical lines painted on the wall, each one of them with 18 or 19 tick marks. And that would make sense that that would actually have been a calendar where they were keeping track of that that long 18.5-year lunar cycle. So lots of cool evidence that these were really great skilled astronomers with no written language. Yeah. All of this passed down by oral tradition. Yeah.
So what was the sky like at night?
We didn't have great luck with the weather. It was we were in the monsoon season. Mm-hmm. We picked these nights because it did overlap with the Perseid meteor shower. Mm-hmm. And we were in Chaco Canyon, which has some of the darkest skies in the world. But it was sort of cloudy, rainy in the early evening and stormy, lightning storms. And then everybody would go to bed and I would stay up, and then the clouds would clear and it was gorgeous. Uh-huh. So I got a treat. Mm-hmm. I got to view some spectacular skies, but it was always pretty late at night, after midnight. Yeah. And they're so dark there, the skies are so dark, so close to pristine dark, that in fact, many of the sites we were are have been accorded special status by the International Dark Sky Association. CHOCO is an IDA, International Dark Sky Association, official dark sky park, and Hovenweep is a dark sky park, and Mesa Verde also is proud of its very clear dark skies.
How many stars could you see?
Well, the most you can see under the best of conditions is somewhere between 5 and 8,000. So I'm going to say between 5 and 8,000.
Did you see shooting stars?
We did.
Sorry, that's not the astronomical.
Shooting stars was fun. Oh, come on, come on.
Astronomical. That's not astronomical. Not right.
Probably closer to the truth. We saw plenty, but it was actually a very low year for the Perseids. Mm-hmm. It was disappointing.
I saw one.
Did you? Good.
Yeah. Good. Yeah, I went outside at night to pee. And there it was.
There it was.
Yeah, so the sky that you saw, is it like the same sky here? We just can't see it, more or less?
It is so much more present there. I think it's largely because we're hemmed in by trees here everywhere. Mm-hmm. You know, the amount of sky you see, even if it's perfectly clear and dark out, is so much less. Unless you're on a bare hilltop. Mm-hmm. Around here in the Northeast, you're looking sort of from the bottom of a can up at the sky because of mm-hmm. all the trees. Mm-hmm. Whereas out there, the horizon might be tens or even hundreds of miles away, and you've just got this spectacular open sky, and then it's so clear and so dark so much of the time, as soon as the monsoon afternoon storms clear out, that you're just, you feel as if you're sort of halfway between the earth and the sky. Mm. You're just enveloped in stars, and the Milky Way is unmissable. It's right there in front of you, plain as day, so to speak. And the details in the Milky Way, you can see the dark lanes that that people in Mesoamerica and South America actually developed into their own so-called negative constellations, where they could see the Milky Way so clearly that they saw figures and characters and animals in the dark parts of the Milky Way and had stories about them. Wow. So these are things that most Americans never see, because 80% of the country is so light polluted that more than 3/4 of the population never sees the Milky Way.
So the names of some of the constellations, you know, like Big Bear, Little Bear, whatever, or the gods and the animals that a lot of constellations are named after, like if there's a really clear sky. Well, sometimes I hear these names, I'm like, I don't see any Big Bear in that. I guess it's really a Big Dipper, but how do they come up with a bear? Uh-huh. Yeah, like if there was more like...
It's easier. You can see so many stars. The Big Bear, so the Big Dipper is only about half of the Great Bear. And if it's a dark sky, you can much more clearly see that the Dipper of the Big Dipper is the body of the bear, and the bear has legs that extend down and make the constellation much bigger. It makes more sense.
Yeah, okay. So how is it that they've been able to keep the skies dark out there?
Mostly it's because of lack of development and population. Yes, uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Desert and people, not too many people want to live
there. There are great big cities in the desert, as you know, that are in the Sun Belt and that are attracting hundreds of thousands of new residents every year, like Las Vegas and Phoenix. And they are growing hand over fist out into their surrounding desert. And those are horribly light polluted places. Uh-huh. But fortunately, the areas where we were are very remote, hundreds of miles away from uh-huh. major cities. Uh-huh.
I got two more questions. One is, anything light pollution related in Northampton that's going on?
Sure.
Is there more you want to say? I'm sure there's plenty more to say. But is there anything like burning on your mind about New Mexico and your trip?
Just about how wonderful it is to spend a week sleeping under the stars. I slept under a tent only, I think, two nights out of the mm-hmm. eight nights I was out there, mm-hmm. and the rest I was just out in the open under the stars.
Scorpions like it too, I hear.
I did have a scorpion on my leg at one point, but no sting.
In the middle of the night.
In the middle. No, I was. We were sitting around a campfire.
Okay.
Yeah. It's just so profoundly moving to see the stars like that. They're such a presence. They're just so obvious and so strong, and there's so many, and it's so easy to see why they played such an important role in all of our shared history and culture. You can't pick up a newspaper or a magazine or see a movie or hear a song without hearing a reference to the sky, the stars, the planets in some way or another. Even though most of us don't see those things anymore, it's still this very important part of our cultural heritage. And out there, you get it. You can see why that is.
You can feel it.
You feel it.
That's cool. How can we get some of that heritage back or keep from losing it so quickly?
It used to be here in Northampton, too. It used to be all around the world. I guarantee you that the Native Americans who live here in the Northeast also had deeply rich connections with the sky, and that the sky was incorporated into their spirituality and their cosmology, as well as their practical lives in ways that we've completely lost. Yeah. How can we get it back? Well, start small. Start by turning off your porch lights and your barn lights and your garage lights when you don't need them, and also turn them down so they face down only, not sideways. It's easy to do. Most of them are on hinges. Or if your porch light is blasting out into the neighborhood, you could just replace the light bulb with a spotlight that points down instead of a floodlight that goes out. And then getting a little bit bigger, you can contact your elected official, your mayor or your city councilor or your select board, and ask them to pass good outdoor lighting regulation in your town, to develop an outdoor lighting plan. The majority of light pollution comes from street lights. So if your town or city hasn't already converted to LED streetlights, make sure that you go to the International Dark Sky Association website, darksky.org, and find out about what the good kinds of streetlights are, and make sure that your city knows about that. If they have already made the conversion, you might be able to convince the city to install dimmers or glare shields to cut the excess light and keep it where it belongs, which is going straight down.
In Northampton, do they have like a form still where you can ask for like a shield or a dimmer or something?
Yes. 2 years ago, Northampton replaced their old streetlights with new LED streetlights, and they opted not to install glare shields or dimmers. And there is a form online on the city website at Northampton, what is it, northampton.org or .gov?
Yes.
Northampton, I can't remember the website. Anyway, you'll find it. Yeah. There's a form you can submit to have the city come install a glare shield to stop the light from shining into your bedroom window or onto your property or into your garden.
Any astronomical events coming up that we should pay attention to?
Well, many people have been asking astronomy friends like me, what the heck is that big red thing in the sky every night? The planets have just been spectacular right now. The big red thing is Mars. It's very prominent in the south, high up in the south at nightfall. Jupiter is a little to its east. Saturn is to its east. Jupiter is to its east. And following very closely behind the sun right now is Venus. All summer long, those four brightest of the naked eye planets have just been spectacular, and they're still shining bright.
Any recommendations on where people can go to see them?
Any place with a big, wide-open view. So go to a hilltop. Here in Northampton, one of my favorites is the community garden, across from the community gardens. I think that's fenced in now.
The recreation fields are on Burt's Pit?
Yes, yeah, on the other side.
Ellerbrook Fields or something?
Yeah, that's right. Yes, just above that. But any open area with a low view of the horizon would be great. You know, you might try the dike along the Connecticut River, for example, in Hadley. That should have a pretty good view.
Cool. Thanks. Anything else?
No.
Thanks, James.
Yeah, thank you, Ruthie.
That was an interview with James Lowenthal, an astronomy professor at Smith College here in Northampton. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. I'm your host, Ruthie Woodring, and that interview made me think of a couple songs. I'm going to play this Buffy St. Marie Starwalker.
Starwalker is a friend of mine.
Here's another song that came to my mind today when I was thinking about James's interview with Paul Simon. Accompanied by, I'm sorry, I don't know her name. I can't find it right now. But I'll tell you at the end.
Joseph's face was black as night. The pale yellow moon shone in his eyes. His path was marked by the stars in the southern hemisphere. And he walked his days under African skies. This is the story of how we begin to remember. This is the powerful pulsing of love in the pain. After the dream of falling and calling your name out. These are the roots of rhythm, and the roots of rhythm remain. Township of Mofolo, give her the wings to fly through harmony. She won't bother you no more. This is the story of how we begin to remember. This is the powerful pulsing of love in the rain. After the dream of falling and calling your name out. These are the roots of rhythm, and the roots of rhythm remain. Ka-boom-ba, boom-ba, boom-ba, boom-ba. Shone in his eyes. His path was marked by the stars in the southern hemisphere. And he walked the length of his days under African skies. I had a
And that was Paul Simon and Miriam Makeba from live from the African Concert 1987. You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP 103.3 FM in Northampton. Thanks for tuning in today. During the song, we had a caller who mentioned that Buffy St. Marie actually went to UMass, and Buffy St. Marie and Taj Mahal actually started the Pioneer Valley Folklore Society a few decades ago, I believe, but that's pretty cool. Ancestors, roots, founders. Anyway, I have another story I want to share from this morning. I don't know, it's just a little interaction I had downtown. Oh, wait, I'll play the Bike Lab PSA, and then I'll go into it.
You want to learn to fix your bike? How to keep it tuned up so it's there for you when you need it? Or maybe you know already, but you just need to borrow a bike-specific tool that you don't have. Well, come to the Bike Lab.
Almost every Saturday since 2004, from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. here in Northampton at 12 Northern Avenue.
Come with your bike or your questions.
And your willing attitude.
Spare parts scavenger hunt every weekend.
Vengan al Bike Lab de Northampton, el taller de bicicleta. Aprende a arreglar tu bicicleta y a divertirte.
All repairs guaranteed to the end of the driveway.
Details are online at pedalpeople.coop. That's the Saturday Bike Lab at 12 Northern Avenue. They say freedom isn't free, but at the Bike Lab it is.
So a couple months ago, someone came to the Bike Lab who got referred from the drop-in center, the resource center, or Grove Street, and didn't have money but had time, and so he worked on fixing up a bike for himself. He told me he used to drive a taxi cab, but he had lost his job, and I was staying on the street. And so anyway, so he was going to come back the next week but didn't show up, but then I see him like once a week when I come in the morning to do downtown trash. I see him early in the morning. Anyway, so this morning I was on Main Street at this point, and he walked across through the crosswalk, and he walked my way, and he asked him how he was doing, and because he didn't look very good, and he came up to me and he was like, "Hey, do you still have that 10 speed?" And I was like, "Yeah, it's still there. If you want to come back some Saturday, you can finish it up." He said, "Yeah, I think I got like 15 minutes left to finish it up." And I said, "Yeah, you know, if you want to do a work barter or something, that's cool, that's fine, whatever." And then I was like, "Are you okay?" I asked him if he wanted a garbage bag because it was a little bit rainy, but he said not. He's like, "No, I got a bag." And I was like, are you okay? You look a little unsteady on your feet." And he didn't really say anything, and like his hand was bandaged, and I saw he had like the white plastic bracelet on. I was like, "Did you just get out of the hospital?" And he was like, "Yeah." I was like, "You look a little unsteady on your feet. Are you okay?" And he was like, "Yeah, I'm going over to the resource center. I'll tell you when I'm better." And I don't know, the way he said it just sort of, I don't know, made me really feel something a little sad, or like, you know, that we have this desire to see everybody doing well and people healthy and happy and not suffering. And I don't want to place too many of my judgments on him, but anyway, I wish all the people out there I wish people's needs be met, whether they're physical, emotional, material, spiritual, whatever. So you're listening to Out There. I've got another interview. I just realized, no, this isn't an interview. This is another clip though. I got a 6-minute clip, I think. I just realized that the next time I do my show will be in 2 weeks, which will be after Election Day, after the September 4th primaries. And I would have liked to have had all the candidates on my show, but I'm more of it's the opposite of proactive, retroactive. I'm not sure. No, react or something. I interview people that come my way easily or happen to be in my path. So instead of interviewing Joe Comerford, who's running for state senate, I talked with Alex Gieslin, who came to my house campaigning for her. This was maybe a month or two ago. Oh, yeah. June 13th.
First, I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself, and then I'm going to ask you what you're out here doing today on a Sunday afternoon.
I'm Alex Gieslin. I live on Riverside Drive, and I've been involved in the city. I was a city councilor for a while, and been working for good candidates, and that's what I'm out today, working for Joe Comerford, who's running for Stan Rosenberg's seat.
For the state Senate, Massachusetts State Senate.
Yes.
Okay. So, like, you're going door to door. You have your list of addresses here that you're using?
I have a list of addresses of people who are unenrolled and Democrats, and because it's an uphill road. People have to write her name in. There's only one candidate appearing in the primary. The vote's in September. So got to reach out for as many people as possible and let them know about Joe and let them know about the primary.
Because this is like a serious public education campaign, because people are going to go into the ballots. They're going to see that sheet. And there's just going to be Chelsea Klein and...
That's it. Right. She won't appear on the ballot. So you're going to have to write her name in.
Okay.
And it's really important. I mean, Stan served us very well for 30 years, and I hate to lose him. It's important. It's really important. And for my money, Joe is just the best qualified. She's been organizing, working on the issues that I care about. Education, anti-war, minimum wage. She's ran the National Priorities Project, which was nominated for Nobel Prize. She's a major player in MoveOn, worked for the minimum wage, raising the minimum wage, all sorts of issues. And she's used to working with people, networking, and just the kind of stuff that Stan was so good at, an honest broker.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she also directed the American Friends Service Committee Western Mass chapter for quite a while too, right?
For a while. She took over for Francis Crow. I think that was one of the first jobs she had when she moved into the Valley. It's got to be, at least 25 years ago.
I mean, you may be exaggerating there, because I've been here 15 years, and I think she was...
She was there? Was she?
No, I've been here, how long has I been? 16 years. And I think she was...
Is she still doing that?
Oh, yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe she moved on. Like, she was director, I think, when I moved here.
Time goes by very quickly.
I know. It becomes a blur after a while. yeah, and so she's also a neighbor of yours. Like, I feel like there's a lot of candidates who share our values. What makes her stand out to you?
To me, her experience. She's used to working in government, with government. She understands it at really every level. Her partner's on the school committee in Northampton. She's been an advocate for kids forever. I mean, she organized for Safe Streets in her neighborhood 4 or 5 years ago. She's just a person who can move things along, who can get people to work together. All of the issues that are so important really need to reach out to people. You got to be able to do that. And she's a very persuasive, very dynamic speaker.
So when is the primary?
Primary September, good question.
Fourth. Your button says write in September 4th.
Fourth, right. And you have to write in her name because it won't be on the ballot.
Okay. And this is primaries for people who are registered as Democrat or unenrolled?
Yes.
Okay. And since it's a write-in campaign, why don't you tell us how to spell her name?
It's Joe, J-O, Comeford, C-O-M-E-F-F-O-R-D.
Wait. Sorry. E-R-F-O-R-D?
Yes.
It's a good thing I got your button here so I can... read it.
Comeford.
Excellent. Anything else you want to add?
No. I just I really hope that people get involved in the primary. It's one of the most important elections we've had in a year that's so crucial everywhere in the country. Getting good people into government is, we're really at a watershed. Another 2 years of a Republican-dominated country is really... I don't know what would happen. They would be in charge. They're in charge of the census. They're going to redistrict, strip perhaps another congressional seat out of Massachusetts, send it to God knows Texas, Florida. It's time to establish some balance and to get a real conversation going. And cool. I think Joe would be a real addition to that locally.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for hitting the streets on behalf of democracy.
Thank you. Thank you for always, Ruthie.
You're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio. So don't forget to vote if you're registered, I think, Democrat or unenrolled for the September 4th primaries. And I think I'll play another song. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up at 5 o'clock. This is Flavor.
She just a shine like a morning light. I can see very clear. She just a shine in a broad daylight. And she was walking and I was watching every step and the move she was making. She is adoring, I am admiring her hips and her curves. Beauty is a natural thing, original thing and a mysterious thing. Raise up my voice and sing, I thank the Lord for a beauty queen. Cause your black is beautiful,
beauty from my bones.
Baby, your black is beautiful, baby, more
beauty in your eyes.
And your black is beautiful, black is beautiful. And your black is natural, black is original. She is black, she is proud and she knows it. She is cool and everybody likes it. She is bold and she's very, very humble. She is strong and can never, never fumble. She is courageous, a Sagittarius, the kind of woman I can take so serious. She's got the fire in her eyes that when you look at her, you will realize. Beauty is a natural thing, original thing and a mysterious thing. Raise up my voice and sing, I thank the Lord for a beauty queen. Cause your black is beautiful, baby, your black is beautiful, baby, more than
your eyes.
And your black is beautiful.
You're listening to Out There on Valley Fee Radio. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up at 5 o'clock. Also, coming up this weekend, Friday, August 24th, in Holyoke at Gateway City Arts, Big Sam's Funky Nation coming up from New Orleans. Also, I was trying to figure out if there was a Friday night concert in downtown Northampton this Friday, but I'm not sure. Probably lots of things going on everywhere, all the time. And don't forget to just sit and look at the stars. Thanks for listening, and yeah.
Hello, everybody. I'm DJ Panic, host of OK Asia, a program with a wide selection of Asian artists. I like to combine genres from rock, pop, hip-hop, Bollywood, and R&B. So please join me every Saturday from 12 to 2 a.m. on Valley Free Radio.
iHeart J-Rock with DJ Sakura is your weekly two-hour show devoted to rock music from Japan. Join me on Saturday nights, 10 p.m. to midnight. I'll be playing the very best and the newest J-Rock, J-Pop, J-Metal, VK, you name it, I'll play it, as long as it's from Japan. Thank you.
Hi, my name's Leo, and I use he, him, his pronouns.
Hi, my name's AJ, and I use they, them, theirs pronouns.
Did you know that sex is your biology and gender is how you identify?
You can't assume someone's gender.
Based on their clothes.
Based on their hair.
Based on their voice.
Who they hang out with.
Who they're attracted to.
My gender isn't your business.
Ask me my pronouns!
Brought to you by the PVPA Student Group for Gender, Sexuality, and Diversity.